Hey everyone, welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this week I am talking with winemaker Lenz Moser. And if that name sounds familiar, it should, because the Moser family, the Moser Winery in Austria, is certainly one of the most famous in that country. Known, of course, and just a champion for Gruner Veltliner. Lenz, his grandfather, I think it was his grandfather. Yeah, it was his grandfather, actually in the 1950s invented sort of the high training system for grapes. Like in terms of viticulture, you know, this guy, we study about him in my wine classes. When you're learning about the different ways of planting grapes, Moser's name comes up. His wines, the Austrian wines are fantastic. But what was interesting about this interview is that Lenz is actually working in China, making high-end Cabernet Sauvignon. And I got the opportunity to interview him, and it was really interesting. I'm splitting this one up into two parts because there was so much to talk about someone who, you know, goes from Austria, you know, which you're talking about very steely, acidic, expressive white wines, to China, something he started to do back in 2000, I think around 2005. So this is going to be a two-part interview with him, and just a great talk about the winemaking culture in China, where it is now versus when he got there, his relationship with the Mondovi family. Mondovi? Did I say Mondovi? I would say the name of the winery, but I'll let you listen to the podcast where I screw it up there. Because remember, when I screw up names, it's not just European countries, not just things here in North America. I allow myself on a global level to mess everything up. A couple other things before I end this. Again, I hope everyone is doing well and is good and safe. And I should tell everyone, this interview was done near the end of January. Because you're wondering, oh, a winemaker making wine in China. Did you talk about coronavirus? Of course I would have. But this was done near the end of January, end of January or early February. Man, have things changed since then. I pushed this one back a little bit because there was other winemakers that I wanted to get out a little bit newer and get their stories about what was going on in Italy with COVID-19. So you need to know that on the front end, because you'll listen to the whole thing and you'll think, cause you're a dummy. And not just because you say too much and you mispronounce all these names and regions. Why didn't you mention coronavirus? Well, it's because it wasn't really part of the conversation. And again, wow, have things changed in a couple months. So I hope everyone is good and safe. One other little shout out. I am helping out because it's actually my girlfriend and her twin sister and a friend of theirs started a Twitter account and an Instagram, and they've started their this little project called Wine Bottle Travels. And it's really simple. It's just cool pictures of great places that we have all traveled, different wineries all over the world, and you'll learn a little bit about the regions, you'll learn a little bit about wines. It's just really fun, easy tips when it comes to travel, when it comes to wine. If you want to follow, it's W Bottle Travels on Twitter, but again, just Google Wine Bottle Travels. You'll find their Instagram account, you'll find their Twitter account. It's still fairly new, so it's going to be limited, but it's going to be just fun posts that you'll be able just to learn a little bit of stuff over in the near future. So some great stuff there to keep an eye on. All right, without further ado, and again, thanks everyone for listening and downloading the podcast. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, all that sort of stuff. Again, hope everyone is good. Hope everyone is safe. And now, part one of my interview with Lenz Moser.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And in terms of interesting journeys, it's hard to get better than this. Our winemaker, Len Moser V, part of one of the most famous, if not the most famous, winemakers in Austria, historical winemakers. And now his journey has taken him from Gruner in Europe to making some of the most fine wines you can get in China. It is Len Moser. Lenz, thank you so much for doing the podcast.
Thank you as well.
This is, I mean, let's just start here. I'd love to hear some of your journey. How do you go from, as I said, Gruner in Austria to now making high-end Cabernet-based wines in China. I'd be curious a little bit about that journey.
The journey takes us back 15 years when I went to China for the first time in my life in order to sell my Gruner Veltliner. I did it very, very successfully, but I came away with a little present from China, a winemaking project by Changyu. Mm-hmm.
And what was it about? What was it about the land there, the wine infrastructure, where even back then you could say to yourself, because I've read your quotes, the potential is limitless. It's almost too big to fail. What was it that you? What were your initial impressions?
My initial impressions were very simple. The hardware I found in China, in terms of technical support and equipment, was absolutely unrivaled to what we have in Europe. Mm-hmm. What was missing was the international expertise. Mind you that China has very, very good winemaking universities. There's two, one in Northwest and the other one is in Ningxia itself, pumping out something like 500 to 600 students per year. But what they are missing at the time was international knowledge and experience. And this is what I'm bringing to the party.
I read that when you consider Ningxia, that's the appellation, and the wines you're making, Chateau, and excuse if my, hopefully my pronunciation is all right, Chateau Shengyu Moser, and you describe that area as what Napa Valley was about 40 years ago. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit just about what you meant by that.
In 2009, the leaders of Changyu asked me where we should put the chateau, where we had a contract in terms of me giving also the name, Chateau Changyu Moser 15. Moser is my part, and 15 is 15 generations of Moser family in the wine industry, dating back to 1610. And I went around China, and I found Ningxia in 2009 already, where there was nothing big going on at the time. Mind you that Ningxia was becoming a wine-growing country in the late 80s. And so it was virgin territory, but I saw the potential. And I saw one thing which I think is very, very important. I saw the smallest Cabernet Sauvignon berries in my life.
Really?
Yes. And why is this? Because it's an altitude of 1,100 meters and it's desert climate. And in order to protect the berries, they produce a very thick skins and they don't grow very big. And what that means for a winemaker is an abundance of flavor, of tannins, and color. And I said, this is the place I want to be.
That is interesting. And yeah, you're right when you said like the tiny little grapes, and that is where a lot of the intensity comes from. And we're going to bounce around all over this interview. I read that, you know, one of your, you know, your favorite wines, your part and your background is in Gruner, but in red, it is in Cabernet Sauvignon. And, you know, I know you've mentioned like Opus One a bunch of times. So for you, that totally makes sense for the wines you love, just that big, powerful expression of such an important grape in our industry.
Absolutely. I was brought up with Bordeaux by my father. Mm-hmm. Very privileged, I know. I was sent to California in my student years, and that's how I got to know Bob Mondavi and his family, and of course Opus One and some other really nice places. And that really shaped my love and my passion for Cabernet-based wines, mm-hmm. as opposed to Pinot Noir. I love Pinot Noir as well, don't get me wrong. But I just don't have the expertise to understand this very, very difficult microclimate of Burgundy and other Pinot Noir producing countries. But so I specialized in Cabernet Sauvignon. I'm really, really happy because 80% of the acreage in Ningxia is Cabernet Sauvignon, and 100% at the acreage of the Chateau is mm-hmm. Cabernet Sauvignon. So that's all I have to play with.
Yeah, and I want to play with, and I've never seen this before. You have made, actually, before we get there, the one thing I realized, do you ever notice in the wine world, everyone's got to pick a side? You're either Bordeaux or Burgundy. You're either Cabernet or Pinot Noir. It's so funny that like everyone has to always define themselves. You're either on this camp or you're on the other camp.
Yes, that's true. And for me, I think it was how I was socialized with wine. My father just took me to Bordeaux when I was a kid, or almost, and he always left out Burgundy, so I did not know too much about it. I think that's it. But I tell you one thing, if somebody, a friend of mine, gives me a good bottle of Pinot Noir, I'll die for it.
Yeah.
Because as Michael Broadbent once said, Pinot Noir is the wine going directly to your heart, because it's soft, it's elegant, and it doesn't have these tannin blockers, which really prevents you going to your heart immediately. So there's some beauty in Pinot Noir as well.
Of course. Was there a bottle that made you realize where it all clicked? Like, obviously, you've grown up with wine your whole life, so you were influenced it more than the average person. But was there a bottle somewhere in Bordeaux, or even, you know, in Austria, that really made you realize, I need to learn everything about this, because this is a beautiful moment I'm having with some bottle?
When I was still a student, I went to Bordeaux and I stayed a summer at Chateau Kirvan, a Troisième Grand Cru, by the family Schröder and Schüller, which were at the time friends of my parents. And they took me around to all the nice first and second growths. So it's hard to pick one of these, but that really got me going on Bordeaux. And I was lucky to have started at the very, very top.
Of course, the only problem is you've nowhere left to go. If you are in school and you're drinking Pichon-Ronville or something, it's hard to go from there to the more factory made wines.
Yeah, but it shaped my thinking, and it shaped my passion for excellence, and I think it plays out nicely now with my project in China, because I have to get out of bed every morning, but I do it with the fixed notion that I want to produce something really worth it, and best of China is what makes me tick in this particular project.
And for you, it's almost the undiscovered country. I mean, we know what Europe is, and it's the best, but you get to go now and play with this almost new microclimates and these soils. And some of them obviously are very similar to Europe, but, you know, you get to go more in the unknown, and which starts with this one. I if it's all right to pour, to try a little bit, I'd love to hear the story behind something I had never seen before until I was researching you, a white Cabernet Sauvignon. Can you explain this wine to the listeners?
A white Cabernet Sauvignon is something completely new. It's unique, and it's very, very innovative. And I did it because I had to. I'm the only winemaker in the world, probably, who makes a white, a rosé, and a red from Cabernet Sauvignon. But that's all I have to play with. And when I started in 2015 making the wine, I had to come up with a white for Europe, for exports, because Europe also wants whites, not just reds. And I remembered something I did in 1996 in Austria. At that time, it was a very, very bad red wine vintage, and my red Cabernet grapes, even after pressing, turned to a white wine.
Really?
Yeah. So this was the first ever done. It was hugely successful. We did about 100,000 bottles in that particular year in our estate back home in Austria. And the only trouble I had with this, next year was a good red wine year again, so I had to abandon the idea. But when I came to China, I remembered that it can be done, a white Cabernet from red Cabernet grapes. And so I convinced Cheng Yu to do it, and very much to our surprise, it was so good in year one that we sold out immediately, and now one third of our production is white Cabernet.
And wasn't part of it also on the domestic level, just a high percentage of the female drinkers were preferring white wine. So domestically, it was important for you to make a wine like this?
Well, domestically in China, it's still virgin territory, but mind you, in China, 90% of the consumption is red wine. Mm-hmm. Also the ladies, but you're absolutely right. The young students coming back from America, from Europe, back to China, they fall in love with white in particular. And therefore, there's a new demand for white wines. And that's why this wine, the white Cabernet from the Chateau is very successful now in China as well. And also for another reason, because I can credibly say the white Cabernet Sauvignon has the soul of red Cabernet Sauvignon. All we do is to take out the color and the tannins.
On the nose, it's a little bit lighter, more fragrant, more floral. A lot of very expressive white stone fruit. But I guess I didn't know what to expect. I'm such a dummy. My first thought was, oh, it's going to be a big brooding wine because I see the word Cabernet Sauvignon. But no, I mean, it's the color. It looks like the lightest, palest rosé you're going to get out there. If you were telling people what they're, I'm getting similar on the palate as well. It's got a nice length to it. Like I can still taste it 20 seconds later. How would you describe your white Cabernet Sauvignon?
Well, first of all, it's a completely new category. It's something you've never tasted before because it's the only one in the world. So either this or nothing. And what I love and I adore is the cornucopia of different flavors in the nose already. I always describe it as, grapefruit peel when you smell it and a little bit of gooseberries. So the closest analogy I can give you is somewhere, and it's not entirely true, but it's pretty similar to a Sauvignon Blanc on the nose with a little bit of spice in there and then the fatness of a Chardonnay. So it's somewhere in between these two. This is as close as it gets. That's as a description.
Oh, yeah. The closest analogy, I was thinking Sauvignon Blanc, which, I mean, I guess kind of works. White Bordeaux, Sauvignon Blanc, Cabernet Sauvignon, Bordeaux-style grape. So there's going to be some similarities. If I was going to sell this wine, I think I would sell it as you want the body of Chardonnay. You're kind of tired of the insipid Pinot Grigio that we get in a lot of New World markets. This sort of satisfies a couple of your different tastes in wine, and this one can be versatile, can give you a lot of different stuff.
Absolutely, and it's really successful in the first market we tackled in Europe, in the UK. We have places where we sell this wine by the glass in quantities more than 100 bottles a month.
Really?
Yeah, which is absolutely, the Sexy Fish on Berkeley Square in London is one of the hot spots when it comes to seafood. A very, very nice restaurant. And Julian, the French sommelier, fell in love with it. And he sells now more than 100 bottles. And then there's this super new sexy place, which is called Ivy Asia, just off St. Paul's Cathedral. Also another one of completely new hotspots. They sell even more by the glass every year. Of course, it's an Asian-themed restaurant. But people love it because it's new. It's refreshing. And it's something from a different world.
Yeah.
And also it fits a lot of foods because it's not too heavy, but it has some fat at the end, some gras, as a French would say, and therefore it fits a wide variety of foods.
Oh yeah, you could do this with like a thick tuna steak, with a salmon, with lobster. I imagine a wine like this. I imagine you must be selective of the markets or the areas that you sell this to, because you have to sell to areas that have a good wine culture, that have a love for wine. Because I would imagine in maybe an area where wine isn't as critical, this wine would scare off a lot of people that are more used to just their traditional varietals and their traditional areas.
Well, the thing is, yes and no. As long as you are able to taste people on the wine, then they get very, very excited. And it's not just the ladies or the female element of the market. It's the boys as well. They really love it because it's new, and it's just tastes extremely, extremely good. And that's what makes people tick, I guess.
Yeah. So I want to bounce back a little bit, but I also want to get obviously to the wines that you were having here, that you're exposing to the market here and before at the British Wine Fair. But just for people listening who don't know, like when I heard Len Moser was around, I'm like, oh my God, I would love interview you in a second. I was wondering if you tell the listeners who might not know just a bit of the history of your family and the impact your grandfather had on the entire winemaking population.
Well, I'm really fortunate to have my family's history now on the label as well, because the wine I'm making now is called Chateau Changyu Moser 15, Moser obviously is my family name, and we have a history of 15 generations of winemaking in the same village in Austria, funnily enough. And so we date back to 1610, but the most important son of my family was my grandfather. Mm-hmm. He was Lenz Moser III, and he invented modern trellising. So whenever you see wires in a vineyard, this was the guy 90 years ago who invented this. And then came my father, and both were really big mentors of myself. And my father was the first one to go on export after World War II again from Austrian wine. And one of his primary destination and his most loved destination was Canada.
Oh, and really?
Yeah, absolutely. And my company, my father's company at the time, he would sell, I think the peak was 100,000 cases of Austrian Grüner to this country. You are too young for that, but this was a really huge market until the early 80s. So I have very, very fond memories of Canada. Well, we had a little hiccup in Austria called the wine scandal.
Oh, God, of course. Yeah. Right when I said what happened, I read,
And that killed the business, and we never recovered on the export side from this. But I can proudly say that Austria now makes one of the best whites in the world, generally speaking, and we are back in Canada already.
That speaks to the, I don't want to go insecurity, but the volatile nature of the wine market, where you have the scandal that happens, but it shouldn't have, there was of course going to be a negative impact, but it shouldn't have been to the point where Grüner is almost considered, not exotic, but it doesn't have the foothold here it should, just because of a notably a bad incident, but an incident that happened ages ago.
Yeah, I mean,
we get nervous, we get flighty. You do one thing, and then it's like the stock market, where you know you hear one bad thing from the president, and then the Dow goes down 200 points. It can be similar. It can be similar with wine, tastes, and also what people are willing to buy.
Well, but basically it was Austria's fault because we produced that hiccup in the past. But I'm a very, very positive person. And I can tell you it was for the better of the Austrian wine industry altogether, because a new generation of people entered the market, and like myself at the time. And our primary goal was not to be the biggest, but the best.
Yeah.
And at least what we achieved so far was a very, very good base for future growth, because we are now considered amongst the very, very best of whites in the world, especially with Grüner, but also with Riesling and sometimes with Pinot Blanc or even Pinot Gris. So Austria has a very, very good track record of fine wine now.
It's my next trip. Is I just want to rent a car for 2 weeks and do Austria and do Germany.
Oh, fantastic!
Like that's my next big trip wine trip that I want to do. Before I get back into Cabernet Chinese Cabernet Sauvignon, and I mean I got 100 questions for you. I just want to just tell the listeners that are new to it. Sell them on Grüner Veltliner. Sell them when they're at the wine bar and there's six different wines by the glass. And there's two Pinot Grigio and there's a Sauvignon Blanc and there's a Chardonnay, but there's one Grüner Veltliner. Why they should break out of their comfort zone and try the Austrian wine.
Well, the Austrian wine gives you a lot of pleasure. It's lighter than its competitors most of the time, except for Pinot Grigio. And it gives you a broad variety of usage as well, because Grüner fits almost any food you can think of, because it's very, very versatile. And what I consider, Grüner is a very modern grape. It gives you a wonderful smell in the nose. You know, it's white grinded pepper, and it gives you the spritz on the palate, the zippiness, which is longing for the next sip as well. And it's just a very, very pleasant drink altogether. So that's why I'm still hooked on Grüner. And I'll tell you one thing, Wiener Schnitzel is the Austrian favorite dish.
Yep.
There's nothing like a Wiener Schnitzel and a nice glass of Grüner on your trip.
I've seen it all the time. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to do it. This quote I found interesting. When you were hired to be a consultant for the Chateau, you said they told you, you have to make sure you're the best in China, but also be the top in the world. That's some pretty lofty lofty goals when they were brought you in.
No. I mean, China has a tendency of setting clear goals, and I kind of like that, Best of China is relatively easy to achieve, and we achieved that already because there's the competitive clusters about 15 wineries. Mm-hmm. I think when it comes to the global market, top of the world is a tough goal, but I rephrased it for myself. I just want to make sure that we belong in the company of the world's finest. Mm-hmm. And what we increasingly do, we do a lot of blind tasting, not just internally, but also with consumers and with customers and with journalists as well, to tell them where we stand. And not we are telling people that we are the best, but what we really would like to achieve is that in a blind tasting, that you struggle to get out the tops and to say who is who, because then I think we're winning already. And I'll tell you one thing. 2 weeks ago in Hamburg, I had a tasting with 50 people, mm-hmm. all connoisseurs, a lot of journalists, a lot of top customers. And we had two of our top wines against Opus One, against Valbuena, and against Penfolds 389.
Oh.
And all these 50 people had a heated debate for about an hour, and then I stopped it because they were not sure who is who. And I thought this was a cool event.
That's great. I mean, you must have got a nice sense of satisfaction. Because imagine people see the label, we get conservative in our thinking, and we would get scared off by Chinese wine. Is this a novelty? What's going on? If it's Cabernet, it better be California or Bordeaux, and China could scare people off.
Absolutely, because nobody really knows that China is a wine-producing country. Mind you, when I went to China 15 years ago, I had no idea.
Yeah.
I had no idea. But at that moment in time, China was already a large producer. The quality was the issue. And this how we found together in this cooperation, Changyu and myself, in order to go out to the world and be the first to convince the international public that China produces quality. So this is my goal.
I think one way you could help is, early on, what struck me is what convinced you can make quality wine was the tiny little thick-skinned Cabernet Sauvignon grape. If you just show that, especially to the wine media or the sommeliers or wine buyers from Costco to LCBO and everyone else, that look at this grape. If this grape can make it in this microclimate, forget the name of the country, and here's the soil, here's the temperature. Why would it not create this grape?
I will, absolutely right. I don't want to be judged because I'm coming from China. Mm-hmm. I want to be judged by the quality, number one, and this is an absolute term, and the typicity of our wine.
Yeah.
Because we don't want to produce something like America does, or like Bordeaux, or like Burgundy, or whatever. We want to come up with something which is unique to Ningxia. And also my colleagues, my winemaking colleagues in the region and I, we are on a mission to make an unmistakable Ningxia wine, which can be recognized the same way, like if you sniff into a glass of Bordeaux, everyone immediately knows this is Bordeaux.
Yeah, you can always get the Bordeaux smell.
And Chile is the same thing because the articulate smell of Chilean top Cabernet Sauvignon is also very clear. And we pride ourselves at the very early stage of our journey to go after that goal. And I'm very happy to tell you that spice will be an element in this. Coming from these small berries, we have a lot more spice in Cabernet Sauvignon than some other people.
So what should I try next? What did you bring?
You try this one here. Mm-hmm. You try the Helan Mountain Cabernet Sauvignon, mm-hmm. which is our third tier Cabernet Sauvignon, also from the Chateau. And it's the speciality about this wine, you won't believe it when you taste it. Coming from these small berries, we decided we are not going to use any wood treatment at all. There's no chips, there's no staves, there's no barrique aging.
So all stainless steel.
All stainless steel.
Blue Mountain Range. So is that a single vineyard within the area?
No, Helan Mountain Range is very close to the Helan Mountains, which are very close to Chateau as well. It's 120 kilometer long stretch of a mountain range which shields us against the winds from Inner Mongolia. Mm-hmm. So that's why this mountain range is very important.
Yeah, that must make it. How much warmer does that allow for the microclimate there?
It's about 1 to 2 degrees on average per year. So it's not much, but it shields us. Wind is a natural enemy of vineyards because wind destroys the leaves and sort of suppresses photosynthesis, and that's why we're very happy to have this windshield, this natural shield.
I get immediately, it's funny, like, of course, it's hard to give an assessment because now I know what it is, but I think my first thought, this smells a little bit like a cool climate Cabernet Sauvignon. Like the fruit is there, but I do get a bit of the vegetal notes, spice, almost a little bit of blue fruit playing around with the red fruit. It is a lighter, fresher on the palate. It's like like the freshness, a little bit dark red fruit. That's sort of, medium tannin at most. This is a lighter, to me, it's a little bit lighter styled Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yeah, absolutely. It's of course. But what really strikes me that it doesn't need really the wood. If you have a 17 Bordeaux, a non-barrique, you're really hard to chew on a wine like this. And here it comes relatively luscious, natural, and has this spice you just mentioned. And this is the way forward for us. Yeah, pepper. Yeah, this black pepper in particular. Yeah. And this is the way we want to express our terroir and our region.
I think my brain would start to go towards a well-made Loire Cap Franc. I think that might be it's a little bit lighter, but I think there's stuff there that I think I would, and I just know, because like sometimes blind tasting, you always try to game the system. You always try to figure out, I think I would start to go over there with this. So how many, for this particular wine, how long has this line been in production for? Well, or how many vintages, excuse me?
No, we started with a white sheet of paper in 2015 when I took over the management of the Chateau and making the wine. I didn't have a label, I didn't have a wine, I didn't have a strategy, I had nothing. I just had the Chateau and all the hardware I wanted in life, yeah? So this was the best thing ever happened to me as a winemaker and a marketeer in my entire life. And it took me about half a year to make the wine. Then the brand architecture, now we have 6 wines. And then, of course, the route to market and the strategy, how to market these wines successfully, not just in China, but throughout the world. And this was the best time of my life so far, because when do you get the chance? When do you get the chance to put the country on the map? Because we were the first ones to go abroad with the premium range of wines from China at all. So this was pioneering, and you would be surprised to hear the comments from people I went to, because I'm old enough to know a lot of people in the industry, importing industry in particular. And they said, what? Chinese wine? But after tasting the wines, they believed my story and they become even better friends now.
I like to use the word pioneer because I was thinking kind of the same thing. Like if you look at the history of the United States, when people would go out west and the settlers and pick their own land and sort of just go on their own journey, it kind of feels the same way. I'm curious, like, as you said, you had this blank slate a couple of years ago, which on one way, very exciting, very thrilling, very liberating. Another part, that can be very nerve-wracking. Like, how did friends or family, how did they react when you're like, you know, back years ago in like 2005? I mean, you could have stayed in Austria and made killer wine and you never had to worry about, you know, a complete startup and also trying to convince people. You don't need to convince anyone to drink Len Moser Austrian wine. So how did friends and family, how did they, their reaction when you decided this is my new journey?
Well, it was the same reaction pretty much as when I left Austria for California to work with Robert Mondavi. Mm-hmm. Because I was working at Len Moser Winery, had a lifetime contract there. And when Michael Mondavi called me in the mid-1990s, said, Lenz, you must be bored with your Austrian job. Come and join us and you know, do a job with us.
Yeah.
Because I've been a friend with the family already. So people were, and I left the country and I lived in Germany and then partly in the US. So people were just
such different wine cultures you're going
from. Completely surprised. But I tell you one thing: if you work in Austria, this is the National Football League. Mm-hmm. But if you go to America, to California in particular, at the time, this was definitely Champions League, and this enabled me. I wouldn't be sitting here if I would not have had this California experience with the Mondavi family.
Yeah,
because this enabled me to go on to the next stage of pioneering. And this is what it is, and this makes me tick. This is my family's DNA, because my grandfather started modern trellising, my father was the big exporter, and I tried to cultivate Grüner, because the phenomenon of Grüner is barely 30 years old. Because before that, we tried to disguise the name of Grüner on the label, because it was considered as a lesser grape. But my family and my father and myself in particular, we were the first ones to label Grüner Veltliner as Grüner Veltliner in Austria. So this is what we do. Call me crazy, but sometimes it works, most of the time. And I think this is the most important thing.
Yeah, you're blazing your own trail. It's damn exciting. I'm curious, you know, what was Bob Mondavi? I mean, everyone knows the name Mondavi. What was it like? I mean, first off, I love the fact it's like, hey, you got to be bored. Come work with me. I love that ambition from him, that ego in a good way. There's a difference between a strong ego and a large ego. Yeah. You're not going to survive unless you have a strong ego.
Yeah.
But what lessons did you learn working with the Mondavis?
Well, I'm really privileged, because I grew up in Austria and in Europe, conservative schools and trained and, you know, Catholic and all the stuff.
Yeah. All the rigid rules of Europe wine.
Absolutely, absolutely. But then you come to America, you come to California in particular. And, you know, Mike Mondavi said, yeah, you can do it. I mean, this can-do spirit and this why worry spirit, and you can do better and exceed and all this positive thinking attitudes, you know, don't come with a problem, come with a solution and that stuff. This really shaped my life tremendously. And then I had the chance to go to China. This is another planet. It's not just another country. And I feel my life is getting more and more complete with this Asian experience now, because I tell you one thing, we can learn so much from China and from Asia altogether, and particularly China. A people who speak the same language for 5,000 years, who write the same writing for 5,000 years, which I have been trying now for three times to learn Chinese, and I still fail doing it. This must be very, very intelligent people, because the language is unbelievable. So my respect for this country comes from the wisdom of the country, and also from the language as well.
And that ends part one of my interview with Lenz Moser, and him talking about just him fitting in with China and the wine culture there, and just about how much he respects that nation, and just what a crazy story about someone going from two completely different worlds. So the second part of my interview, which both of them are up right now, I started off with, what sort of culture shock was it for him coming from a much more conservative wine background in Europe, where there is 1,000 rules and laws? Again, Austria, very different, not exactly an area where you find Cabernet Sauvignon. So how was it going from Austria, Europe, conservative, to 2005, when he travels to China for the first time and decides, this is a region I want to make wine in? So that'll be part two. That's coming up. Thanks again for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.